At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The great and free-ranging American philosopher William James loved to quote Walt Whitman and to talk pragmatism. He was quintessentially American, or at least the way we once were. Don't get stuck on belief or ideology. Be devoted, radically devoted, to what works for a better world. We could use a touch of that just now, this hour on Point. William James, the philosopher of American pragmatism. You can join the conversation. Is this the true American, the pragmatist, the one who judges by results? Can it be again? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Miami is Robert Richardson, historian and biographer, author of a raft of books on William James. He's edited a just-published collection of essays called The Heart of William James. Marilyn Robinson calls him a kindred spirit whose admiration for James is compounded by his enjoyment of him. Robert Richardson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Happy New Year, Jack. Great to have you here.
Happy New Year, Tom, and hello, Mr. Richardson.
Robert Richardson, take us right in with your thumbnail introduction here. We'll have people who know William James backward and forward, and others who will have no idea who you're writing about and who you've celebrated. Introduce us to William James.
William James was born in 1842. He was in New York. He was part of a great family. His father was a well-known man about town. William's younger brother, was Henry James, who became a great American novelist.
Of course.
Then there were two more brothers. And then there was a sister named Alice James. And Alice James became a great diarist, Henry the great novelist, and William a great philosopher, psychologist, and sort of founder of the modern study of comparative religions. The family lived in New York City for a while, and then it traveled all over the world as the father tried to get an education for his children, but was continually yanking them out of school and putting them into another one. Mm-hmm. Then they moved to Newport, Rhode Island. Eventually, they moved to Boston, Massachusetts. William was never allowed to go to college. His father thought that college ruined you, and that's because college ruined the father.
He had been a rich kid at college, smoking cigars and drinking and frittering away the family fortune.
Right, spending all his money on oysters. So the father decided no college.
Mm-hmm.
But he did allow William to go to what was then called the Lawrence Scientific School, which was a sort of sub-school at Harvard where you could study science, and he did that. And he eventually began to teach science. He then became interested in medicine. He got a degree from Harvard Medical, and the only degree he ever had, the only earned degree. He had no high school diploma. He had no college degree. He once wrote a piece sort of mocking the PhD called the PhD Octopus.
Octopus, right. Yes, he did. And you called him – we're going to get to the effusion of work that came sort of from that point. But you've called him the man with the most free-ranging mind of any American thinker. Give us a sense of that range. What did he apply that mind to?
Well, the range comes in this. James makes a major contribution in philosophy. He makes a major contribution in psychology. He makes a major contribution in religious studies. In all three of those, he upended most of what had preceded him and began something new. In religion, it was religious experience, not Bibles and schools and priests or holy people. It was the religious experience of individuals that is the heart of religion for James. In psychology, he began with a spectacular demonstration that emotions don't start and then lead to actions. What happens is the reverse. We have a physiological reaction to something, and then the emotion comes in its wake. We are afraid because we run away from the bear. It's not that we feel fear and then we run away. It's when you physiologically run that the fear comes up. So James really changed everything that he touched, all these fields.
And when he goes to pragmatism, that can have a very kind of humble, not so special sound to it these days. But in James' hands, that was a very big deal. Describe why for us.
Pragmatism was meant to counter idealism. And idealism has always had a good name and good press, and it sounds lovely to have ideals. But the problem with it as a philosophy for James was that it divorced itself from actual life, from actual consequences. And it leads people to believe that what matters in your life is what you intend, not what you actually do. So pragmatism has an immense practical side that's not really very controversial. It's part of child rearing. Anybody who's had a little boy or a little girl tells them, actions have consequences. And that's what pragmatism really is about. It's about judging something, judging, say, an act of Congress, judging a presidential decree by what will happen, what is going to happen, and what does happen. But you have to judge it by all of its consequences, not just – you can't just say, well, it works for me. It has to work for all of us.
A kind of very holistic assessment of results, the fruits, not the roots. And Jack, this came to be seen, Jack Beatty, this came to be seen as something quintessentially American.
Yes, indeed. John Dewey, James's colleague at the University of Chicago, called pragmatism the philosophy of democracy. And by that he meant that pragmatism cleared away the dualisms between substance and accident and appearance and reality and so on that were at the center of European philosophy. And Dewey, and I suppose James as well, felt that those dualisms reflected the class nature, the caste nature of European society. You know, some people were in leisure and some people were helots. That's what the dualisms meant. Well,
helots, pugs, peons,
yes, right.
Serfs, my
that's
people
right.
Back in the day.
Right. If pragmatism sinks all that, all those distinctions. And so there was a kind of leveling about it. And then second, I think there was this view that, and this is put by Richard Rorty, a contemporary pragmatist. He died a few years ago, but the connection between pragmatism, America, and the future. He said that pragmatism substitutes the notion of a better human future for, quote, reality, nature, reason, and all those shibboleths in the old philosophy, so that there was a tie-in between the idea that America was an experiment being tested, its vindication would come in the future, and the pragmatic method. Those two things seemed to fit.
Robert Richardson, is it based on this faith in a better human future, pragmatism?
Yes. That was just beautifully put. Pragmatism is a philosophy of action and the results of action. It's really intended to turn away from the ivory tower, to turn away from the kind of philosophy that boasts that it can lose you in three sentences if it really tries.
Mm-hmm, right. Hello, Kant. Come in, Kant.
It is aimed at a better actual world.
This was seen as radical or ultra-modern. Why?
Because much of philosophy coming down to that time is Platonic or Hegelian, mm-hmm. or the American would be Josiah Royce, who was a good friend of James. But these all believed that the world is – that the real world is an ideal world somewhere and that we are just an approximation of it. And James just thought that this – could not be so, that what was real for him was human experience, or indeed all experience, but human experience is what humans mostly know. But if you begin from that rather than from hopes or abstractions, the great trouble with idealism for James, I think, is abstraction. It's not concrete. It's not real.
How did this catch on? Did Americans recognize what he was talking about? I mean, the word itself, pragmatic, was not in currency until he really started using it, I guess. How did Americans stand up and say, oh, yes, that's us you're describing, or not?
Well, when pragmatism came out and the book came out, the reviews were terrible. Everybody jumped on it. And James was really very unhappy. He thought he had explained himself better than he apparently had for his generation. So from that, we draw that it has been resisted from the beginning.
On the other hand, Jack, isn't this what we're supposed to be? There's an awful lot of Americans out there who have been very proud, yes, of their ideals, but also American pragmatism is sort of the hallmark, at least at one time, of what it meant to be American.
Yes, and even the crudity of it, which I think James even celebrates, the swagger of it. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the cash value of an idea?
He uses that very word phrase.
Right. I mean, you can see a businessman in Chicago at the time saying, by God, that's my kind of philosopher. he didn't sniff at that sort of thing, and the rawness and the roughness and the sense that things are being worked out, that nothing is finished. All of this, I think, and that also, above everything, that circumstances were plastic. That there wasn't this fate out there. There wasn't this, things weren't just destined or determined. The human will could change them. Boy, that was quintessentially American.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the great American tradition of pragmatism and its great philosopher, William James, elder brother of the great novelist Henry James, the man who said a great many people think they are thinking when they are merely rearranging their prejudices, who said there is no happiness without action, and who said man can alter his life by altering his thinking. Robert Richardson is with us from Miami. He's edited the big new collection of essays from William James, The Heart of William James, it's called. Jack Beatty's with us. Robert, Jack, let's plunge right in with our listeners. Lots of responding here today. Shane in Boston, thanks for calling, Shane. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about William James. I had never read him before, but this year I got to read The Varieties of Religious Experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really interested in what he had to say about psychology of religion. And one of the things he talked about is that basically he said there's two orders of inquiry concerning a religious experience. You know, what is it? Describe it. What is its origin? What is its nature? But secondly, what is its value? And he said that the first doesn't have a bearing on the second. The second is not determined. So just because you can attribute lowly origin to a particular experience by saying, you know, this is the result of a psychopathology, doesn't mean that it's not a valuable religious experience, which I just think is, you know, I was totally taken by that. And he gives an example with George Fox, who was the founder of the Quaker religion. He shows a story from his journal entry where he basically talks about something that we would probably describe as him being crazy, you know, showing signs of psychopathology. But he says, you know, look at how the spiritual ability of this man, he started a religion, you know, you can't just describe the origin of what might be the origin of his religious experience and discredit the experience itself. And I think that's related to the pragmatism.
Shane, I'm glad you raised this whole realm because it's far too easy in the wake of how pragmatism has been used over the years to reduce it to the sort of thinking about, I don't know, politicians cutting a deal over some new highway in a back room. There are much grander realms here. Robert Richardson, help us out. William James on
really
religion.
They
take us up there.
The original speech given at Berkeley, California, that launched pragmatism, the original speech is almost entirely concerned with what it means for religious experience. And your caller is exactly right. James is not that much interested in judging a religious experience by its origins. It is by its effect on your life. And James is apt to say that any religious experience that has a lasting, beneficial effect on your life, not just momentary, but lasting and beneficial, is real. And that becomes his definition of real. It is what permanently or for the long run changes our life for the better. So it doesn't really matter if you saw a goddess in a tree or if they can't get a photograph of it. If that experience means nothing to you and you laugh it off and you write a little piece for the paper and forget about it, it means nothing. But if it changes your life, it's real. And this way of validating things by their effect on our lives is the wonderful tonic thing that makes James applicable now and in the future, I think.
Well, he also gave humans great agency. I mean, if it changes, if it improves your life, it's real. But he also said, you know, by your very posture toward the universe, you can improve your life. By your very sort of outlook in action. If I read you and he right, Robert.
That's right. James very deeply believed something that Emerson also believed, and that is that when we finally figure out what reality is, it's going to be something consistent with powers that we possess as human beings. And there's something wonderful about that. It's not going to turn out to be that reality is something that only a tiny handful of superphysicists can understand. It's going to turn out to be something consistent with human powers. And by telling people that the universe is something that they can understand, that they can deal with, it brings us all up to the doorstep of a new world.
And not just that we can understand it, Jack, but he said the inmost nature of the reality is congenial to powers which you possess. It makes human beings fairly significant little critters, Jack.
Oh, you know, it's almost like you can build your own world. It sounds that way. And, you know, the sort of idea of the pragmatic notion of truth is almost your belief is almost causal in that situation. You believe it and you make it so. But you know, this subjectivism, maybe it's the wrong word, I'm not literate in these matters, but this view, say, of religious experience as validating itself, on the one hand, it makes mock of atheistic criticism such as Christopher Hitchens that, you know, oh, it's ridiculous. Right. Let's just look at the doctrine.
Think through the story, right.
Right, just give it up. You know, when someone can have this life-changing experience and he's saying, oh, it doesn't make any sense at all. Mm. I mean, that's just – on the other hand, though, it does leave you in a world of sort of radical subjectivity where people don't appeal to common standards. They say, I had this experience, by God. I can't communicate it. It changed me. It's the foundation of my new life, and you can't question it. There's a kind of locked-in privatism about that.
What about it, Robert?
Well, no, I don't think it's privatism. I think what that is the great founding principle of democracy. Because my experience is valid for me and your experience is valid for you, what that teaches us is that we can't legislate each other's experiences on that. The world is plural. It is not a single monistic world. It's the experience of every individual that counts. Count them, every single one. And that means we have a country of vast plural kinds of reality, and each of them is valid, and that's why one person, one vote works.
Did that sound radical in his day? I mean, we think of ourselves as the great pluralistic era. How did all this sound in, I don't know, 1895?
It sounded radical because it was pulling away from the notion that property is what, or education is what entitles you to a vote. And James would just say, no, it is your membership in the human race.
Let's get a call from Anne in Middlesex, Vermont. Anne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I wanted to speak to, I really think that Americans are really unique in the world in terms of the fact that we come from vast waves of immigrants, even from the colonial times, and have started up our own industries, and were able to break away from Great Britain in our revolution. Even yesterday I was up and visiting relatives and saw the stick that my mother's great-grandfather brought from Ireland and was told he came with that stick as a piece of Ireland to bring, but also to send the huge bag of hard-boiled eggs that he had brought for the voyage. This was the only thing he brought to the country. So, you know, he came with nothing but that, and that's the spirit of America. And I think I think it somehow seems to have been, it appears to have been buried in the last 25 years or so, where the average person feels kind of powerless in terms of the what's going on in politics because of all these backroom deals and the big corporations running the scene and everything. And I think, but I have full faith in Americans finally saying we've had enough, and I think that's starting to happen. I think that it's slow but sure, and I think I have full faith in Americans taking the bull by the horns and starting to vote again and starting to speak their minds.
Ann, I appreciate your call. Robert Richardson, give us a Jamesian response to Ann's view.
That is the Jamesian response. James' family itself came from Ireland, so good to hear. It is the individual experience that matters, and every individual's experience matters, and we have to recognize and honor every individual's contribution. This makes party politics hard. This makes voting in blocks hard. This makes any kind of mob action or herd action more difficult. It's got to do with individuals and individuation and each one being taken seriously.
But what about the sense of disempowerment that Anne's acknowledging, even as she, you know, looks back to what she sees as American strengths?
The numbers of people have increased so hugely. We're now over 300 million. What is it, 308 million?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
counting.
Yes.
It's very difficult to see those as individuals. But anything that you get into, walk into a hospital, it is one individual in each bed. You have to find a way
if they
to
can
see
get
the
in.
Individual.
if they're not lying in the street.
Right. Or it's one individual for each section. We get born one at a time. We die one at a time. Mostly we get married one at a time, unless it's the Reverend Moon's church. There is still a place for the individual, but it has to be hung on to, I guess, with ever whiter knuckles.
Let's go to Brooklyn, New York, and Murray. Murray, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Murray.
Hi, I've got a question about how this actually gets implemented in reality. So I feel that I use pragmatism quite a bit in my job, which is a technical job, and that I use the best tool for the job, and I try to efficiency, and I measure, and I know the effects. But in such a large state machine as the world today, as economics, as politics, if it's difficult to measure, and ideological taint can happen in arguing what the actual effects were,
yeah.
How do we actually apply this? Because I can understand applying it at the macro scale, but not, anything past that.
Murray, that is the great question. And Robert, I'll bring it first to you. I mean, you look out there today. He says, measure everything and look very empirically at everything. But everything gets debated, what the outcome is, what the fruit is. Everything's debated today.
It does. But if you put a pair of scales in your hand and when you hear a claim, you say, is that an intention or is that an outcome? And be as clear as you can to make a distinction between what we hoped would happen, what we want to happen, what we think should happen, all that nice language, and what happens. It's a difficult call to make all the time, but James has confidence that we can make it, probably each in his or her own small bailiwick, and then it gets larger. It isn't messy. It is a messy process. It isn't simple. You can't – and idealism is simpler that way. You can just say, well, I meant well. I meant the best. I meant the best for America. But that's not enough. It's got to come out right.
Jack, what about now? I mean, here we have Murray. He's a technician. He knows what empirical observation is and tight measurement from the technical world. He turns out to our bigger, messier American scene now, and there's such a welter of claims about what works, what gets results, that maybe pragmatism's hard to pursue.
Well, that's certainly true, and we can't find a common – I mean, this gets back to the pluralism. We can't find a common standard for agreement. We could argue that in some ways this is a more pluralistic moment than even his, certainly in the culture,
yeah.
But also in the media. I mean, you liberals go to their channel and conservatives go to theirs, and never the twain shall meet. And so there is a kind of radical pluralism going on there, but it when wish and will and ideology, which I guess is a compound of those, get involved, you're dealing with something more basic than what's corrigible. You're dealing with identity. you know, Kierkegaard says someplace, I can't be myself in the presence of the truth. And that's true of a lot of things in politics. I mean, if we were just dependent on experience, we would change as results change. But something prior prevents us. And I think that something prior is our sort of fundamental value commitments, our identities. And so it's very hard for people to say, well, I was a conservative yesterday, but boy, you know, this Obama policy worked. It changed me. I'm now a liberal. That becomes something scary about a person who could change such something so fundamental so easily.
Is that what William James asked of us, Robert Richardson?
No, I think he's a bit wary, as one should be, of people who can change with everything that comes down. That's why he says that when you judge something by its outcome, it should be by a lasting and beneficial effect on your life, not just, oh, I believe this today and I can believe that tomorrow. You're not free to just sort of believe anything that's floating around that happens to fit in with economic advantage or political advantage at the moment. It has to work in the long run. That makes it difficult to get at. It's true. But there are practical successes that pragmatism can point to. One of them is Alcoholics Anonymous, for example. James is often referred to by Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, as the unacknowledged founder of AA, because it was from reading William James on conversion and what conversion does to you that Bill Wilson got the idea of AA and trying to make the idea of converting people's lives from not productive to productive or from not happy to happy.
So it doesn't mean converting to a particular religion, but converting to what?
From any one thing to something else. Conversion is a psychological process. You can become converted to being a miser. You can be converted from being a miser to being generous. Conversion is not just tied to religion or any, let alone any one religion. It is something that goes on inside. But again, a real conversion is a lasting conversion. And when Bill Wilson set up AA, the idea was to convert the individuals who came in from lives that were messed up by alcohol to lives that were not, to convert them to sober, clean living. And AA has been the most successful alcohol treatment program ever.
So this is sort of, it sounds a bit different than the pragmatism thread. This seems a thread of we are adaptable, malleable, changeable. You can will a change.
We can will a change, and if we can live it, then the outcome will work in our favor. It's very pragmatic. It's all focused on you have to take the action. You can't just intend to get sober. You have to do it.
So many questions coming here. Brian says, if we're talking about pragmatism as if Marx didn't write before James against idealisms. Is Marx a predecessor, I don't know, precedent maker for James? Robert?
No, not really. And interestingly, James seems to have read almost nothing of Marx, which had become tied to socialist politics.
With all that time in Europe, even Germany, he still didn't read Marx?
Right.
London?
Well, he may have read it, but he left no account of it. Mm-hmm. And it's not among his books. He somehow left it out. He got more interested in the other line of things, which was the line sloping toward Freud and psychology. He also got deeply interested in Darwin. And you perhaps can't have all three of those great 19th century thinkers in you at the same time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the great philosopher William James and the tradition of American pragmatism this hour with Robert Richardson. His new collection of essays by William James is The Heart of William James. He joins us from Miami. Jack Beatty is with us, On Point news analyst. And Robert Richardson, boy, have we got questions for you. Here's a good one. Lisa, it's a serious, it's a little long. I'm going to read it here. Lisa writes, could Professor Richardson clarify the relation for James of truth as what works and morality as what is good, or even as you repeated, good for all of us? Many people, she writes, object to pragmatism because it seems to bring a crass type of consequentialist morality. There are many propositions or ideologies that work and have cash value, as you put it, for individuals and groups, and as such are true to the realities of those groups. It's okay to rape women in war. It's good to promote the economic welfare of our, quote-unquote, class that has cash value. I like James, she writes, but find that part of James' thought fuzzy and wanting further explication. Professor, please.
That's a wonderful, wonderful question. It was a great literary critic who called cash value an example of James's disastrous felicity with language. He could come up with things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Billy.
James' notion of truth is also interesting in here. He thought truth was a verb, that truth was a process, not a thing. So you don't have truths. You don't have permanent truths, or what you have is a process of truing. Consider a carpenter with a piece of wood and a plane. He takes the edge of the plane and runs it along the piece of wood, and he trues it. He makes it true. And that's the only sense in which James really accepted the notion of truth, that the truth is something that happens to an idea. It is tested and trued or tried. There are no permanent, great, moral or religious or political truths. There are just the processes that we as small individuals make in which we try to approximate something being consistent.
But even in process, then, to Lisa's question, how do you judge if what works is also what is good? I mean, her point is something could work for you or work for me, but not work for the whole. You know, if you, what about what's good?
That is true. And James had the utilitarian answer, which is the greatest good for the greatest number. And the best you can do is ask if a given action that you are undertaking is going to be good if everybody can do it, or if it applies to everybody, and judge it by that. Greatest, it's not easy.
Yeah. Lisa, I hope that's a beginning. Greatest good for greatest number sounds like a trusty approach, I guess. Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Steve.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi. What's your question?
Hello. Tom, can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Steve. What's on your mind?
It seems that James was very willing to have people question religious, political, philosophical, so-called truths. I wonder what he would think of what some people call scientism, that idea that science has all the truths, and those people who have the audacity to question Darwinism or global warming or the pronouncements of Nobel-winning economists.
Yes. No,
that's a wonderful question, too. James had quite a little run-in with the scientific point of view, and while he was a scientist, was trained as a scientist, as we would call him, he very much objected to positivistic science claiming it had the only answers. He really seriously objected to that and thought that that cut out all kinds of possibilities, that the positivistic scientific view could say this is true and this is not true and that's all. And James would just have none of it. He was disliked by the scientists because he was willing to question scientism, and he was also disliked by the mystics because he was open to mystical experience but wanted it proven.
Let me put this to you from John on Facebook. He says, I'm all for validating experience qua experience, but personal experience alone does not make reality. Any philosophy that doesn't make a distinction between one person's experience of a goddess in a tree and the scientific fact of the tree's existence sounds delusional.
It's not just one person's experience. It's everybody's experience. It's collective experience. If many, many people agree on calling something red, we call it red within that group. So it's not one person's experience and then everything overset. It's reality. What? No. Peirce said, truth is that on which we will finally agree. And the big word
finally.
There is finally.
Oh my
Probably
goodness.
Can't do it now.
That's got a very ultimate sound to it. Jack, I mean, that takes us back I guess if it's going to be about things that are finally true, to a sense that we're headed towards something finally good. The sort of confidence that seems embedded in pragmatism, that we're on a trail of progress, Jack, that we'll look at what works and it'll take us to some, you know, things are working, not just falling apart or not working.
Unquestionably so. And I think, in a way, I picked up my volume of pragmatism for the first time in 40 years and looked at the lines I had underlined. And you know, it's inspiring, and his writing is so vivid. At the same time, you feel this is a moment. He's encapsulated in it, the progressive moment in America when reformers believed that ideas could change things, that we could make a better society on the basis of our ideas of what that should be, that through public education and social training and so on, we could improve. And it was all pre-World War I. Now, here is his brother Henry on August 8th, 1914, reacting to World War I. And I think this puts pragmatism and William James in a kind of parenthesis. I asked Mr. Richardson about that. Henry James writes, "Black and hideous to me, the tragedy that gathers, and I'm sick beyond cure to have lived on to see it. You and I, talking to a friend, the ornaments of our generation, should have been spared this wreck of our belief that through the long years we have seen civilization grow and the worst become impossible. The tide that bore us along was then all the while moving to this as its grand Niagara. Yet what a blessing we didn't know it. It seems to me to undo everything that was ours in the most horrible retroactive way."
This from the younger brother. So what's the question you will pull from that horrible view, Jack? Back to the older brother, William.
He died in 1910, and this optimistic view about shaping the future and, you know, all the verities of the progressive moment seem to have gone to be blown up in the war. And the belief, just that you said, Tom, that progress will work to the betterment, that things will come out, all that blew itself up in the war. We don't believe that, or at least we have to work hard to believe it.
What about it?
That is true. James, of course, was dead by World War I, and so it's very hard to know what would have happened then. But in the late 1899, early 1900, he was in England trying to write the lectures that became the Varieties when the Boer War broke out.
Yes.
And the war, James's approach to the war, I think, tells us something about that. And it's a contrast with Henry.
This is the British in South Africa. It wasn't going well at all at the beginning.
Right. It was the South African War, and it went badly for the English at the beginning. And an interdenominational group of clergymen declared January 7, 1900 as a day of humiliation and prayer. And James was outraged, and he wrote a letter to the paper, the Times of London, to suggest that both sides to the controversy might be satisfied by a service arranged on principles suggested by the anecdote of the Montana settler. The settler who met a grizzly so formidable that he fell on his knees, saying, "Oh, Lord, I ain't never asked you yet for help, and I ain't a-going to ask you for help now. But, Lord," he said, "for pity's sake, don't help the bear."
Don't help the other side. But what do you take from that? And what do you take from it now, Robert Richardson, in a time when we'd like to reach for American pragmatism? There's a strong impulse to do it. On the other hand, things can seem so daunting that many reach for, you know, a line of faith or belief because the immediate stair steps or rungs that pragmatism might, you know, work on can seem murky.
Well, it asks you, what is your relation to the thing you're talking about? James has been called a relativist, but he's not really. He's a relationist. He believes that the only truth available to each one of us expresses our relation to the world and what it is. And that is something that we can make, and it need not be murky. It can be absolute. It involves understanding the other side as well as one's own side, having a little empathy or feeling for the lives of people who are not like us. And all of these lines lead to a kind of pluralistic tolerance of the lives of others. Rather than telling everybody what to do, we need to develop, from James's point of view, a much greater tolerance for lives unlike our own.
It's funny. I mean, you're talking tolerance, but a lot of Americans these days want a game plan, you know, what's it going to be? Kristen in Wellesley, Massachusetts. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hi. First, I want to thank Robert Richardson for his wonderful Emerson biography, just quickly. It's a gem. But I also wanted to say I think it's important that we recognize that so much of James's ideas about pragmatism come out of his work as a psychologist and the principles of psychology, and that really pragmatism is less of a sort of plan or a something that he advocates than a description of what we already do. So that pragmatism is just, you know, I think of it as a description of the way we really do make decisions and operate in the world. And James is less advocating that we be pragmatic than that we recognize what we're already really doing.
That we are pragmatic by nature, but then what does that make of the world we've helped make? Does it mean that it's the best of all possible worlds, Kristen, if we've helped make it?
No, certainly not. But I think what it means is that we've, you know, that when we call an idea true, what we really mean is that we like it, and we wish it to be true, right? So that it's recognizing the human stamp on what it is that we do and have made, rather than claiming that it sort of comes from on high. I think recognizing the human role in what we call the truth.
It's recognizing the process. You've just put it terrifically.
Recognizing the process, but that seems to bring it back to a kind of where's empiricism fitted in there? He also championed that, right? He wasn't just for what we like as truth.
No, but it's got to be radical. Empiricism has to take into account all experience, and that's an enormously wide thing. It cannot just be one's own experience, the exclusion of other people. It has to be a commonality of experiences.
Wow. Matt in Hope Valley, Rhode Island. Matt, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was glad to hear C.S. Peirce mentioned, because I was always taught that Peirce was the progenitor of pragmatism, although his was a much more technical and logically based version.
And William James himself gave credit to Peirce.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Although I think tellingly in pragmatism, he referred to his lectures as Sumerian flashes in darkness.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
But he also calls it practicalism. Yeah.
Right. I think they talk some of the things that you've been talking about kind of come together in the fact that, you know, Peirce's original idea about pragmatism had to do with the metaphysical and a sort of rejection of the idea of one reality. And what he was thinking about when he was thinking about things becoming true or being made true, which was the way in which James said it, was he was really thinking about the scientific community. So I thought that the earlier caller's question about scientism was sort of apropos. Peirce really thought that eventually a community of inquirers would come to, the truth is a limit in a way. They would inquire and eventually come to an answer, and that answer would stand in for the truth in a way that wasn't, you know, ontologically prior to the process of inquiry. And so when you're talking about pragmatism in more ideological or political context, mm-hmm. It seems important to me to note that the way that different people have their own political networks these days means that there's not a community of inquirers who are dealing with the same facts, and that's why that's a problem, and I wondered if you guys could talk about that.
That's pretty terrific, and many have commented on that. You know, Ken online saying the identification of what works in society requires that there's a reasonably accurate portrayal to the public of what is, and Matt takes it even further. If the community of inquiry is fractured or, you know, multi-limbed, our time is so short. But I may be wrong to take it too much into politics, but Robert Richardson, you're a great scholar here. If we were to, you know, get William James' counsel on the American sort of way forward today and how to be pragmatic in this welter of interests that we're looking at, what might he say?
Well, let me give you one sentence from his inaugural lecture on this subject, pragmatism. He says, to attain perfect clearness in our thoughts of an object, then, we need only consider what effects of a conceivably practical kind the object may involve, what sensations we are to expect from it, and what reactions we must prepare. He doesn't guarantee that we're going to make it, but he is suggesting the process by which we should try to evaluate proposals and acts and things that are put in front of us. It has the makings of a political process, but it would be a vast political consensus-seeking process.
Jack, can we still reach for the ladder of pragmatism here? Is that still maybe the American way?
I think so, and I think President Obama gave an example of it in the press conference where he talked about compromise, where he announced the compromise with the Republicans on the tax and unemployment bill. He said something else, and I think this is crucial. He said, this is a big, diverse country. The New York Times editorial page only touches a little bit of it. The Wall Street Journal editorial page only touches a little bit of it. I've got to govern for the whole. I can't just be, you know, saying my view is the right one and yours is wrong. I've got to take into account there was just an election in which the public said, we want the Republican view. I've got to deal with that. That struck me as pragmatism, as wisdom.
Maybe so. Yeah. And yet interest run through every line of that deal.
Yeah.
and every deal that's made. We're not going to wrap this one up in an hour, but we're really happy to get to touch William James for a moment here. Robert Richardson is editor of the new collection, The Heart of William James. Robert Richardson, I hope you'll come back to us on James one day, and not too long from now.
I would love to come back on James.
Terrific to have you with us today, and thanks so much. And Jack Beattie, Happy New Year to you, sir, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrozen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hilary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.